Hi, and thanks for listening to this podcast about the secondary mod. In the next few minutes, I want to cover three things about the book: why I wrote it, what it's about, and to give you some insights into what I discovered. The idea for the podcast came when talking with an Australian friend, Kim Walker. In his very direct Aussie manner, he asked some very probing questions about the background to the book and what I was seeking to achieve. I thought this type of conversation, a series of questions and answers, would be helpful for somebody thinking of buying the book. So Kim, thanks for asking your questions again. Let's hope I give you the same answers as before. Where should we begin?
Thanks, Dick. Here's my first direct Aussie-style question. When we co-authored your last book, you said that you were done with writing, and here you are having published another, and this one has nothing to do with business. What on earth made you do it?
There isn't a short and snappy reply to that question, so bear with me. Way back when I was 11, that's a long time ago, there were two types of secondary school. Grammar schools were for the minority of bright kids, and secondary moderns for the rest. So no surprise about what type of school I attended. My mum and dad always said I should play less football and study more. Anyway, I enjoyed my time at George Gaskell in secondary modern, and did pretty well academically. With a few of my classmates, I went on to study at the local grammar school and then to university. Many more of my class could have done the same, but most decided to leave and get a job. Well, I know they all did well in life. One of them even became a member of parliament. Yet the commonly accepted storyline about secondary moderns is that they were a terrible educational mistake and blighted the lives of the children they educated. I've always wanted to understand why there's such a chasm between my experience and the commonly accepted story about the schools.
That sounds like a question worth answering, but surely you didn't need to write a book to do it.
Well, you're right up to a point. When I started looking for answers, I found a few books that were specifically about secondary moderns, but they were written a long time ago. More recently, whenever historians or the media write about the schools, they consistently tell the same story, using the same arguments, and concluding that they were a failure. If I wanted the detailed history spanning the timeline from when the schools were first conceived through to their demise, and then going a step further to analyse how the schools that replaced them fared to see if they were better or worse. Believe me, I looked very hard for a detailed account, but without success.
It's odd that such a history wasn't available. But maybe the accepted account of schools is correct. They were a terrible mistake, and you were incredibly lucky. It was as simple as that. Seems to me that's what all the evidence suggests.
Indeed, that is possible. But the only way I was going to know was to do the research myself, and that meant going back to the original documents that determine their history and to reach my own conclusions. There's something else. The more I investigated the subject, the more I sensed that the accepted narrative was at best horribly simplified and at worst biased and horribly simplified. We arrogantly believe that fake news is something unique to our generation. It's not. It's existed in different guises across the ages.
That's interesting. Okay, Dick, I can understand why it was important to you and worth studying, but I know the effort involved in publishing a book. You could have done the research, answered your questions, and moved on.
You're right to keep probing, because there are some other reasons that I spent the time researching the subject and then writing the book. I owe a great deal of gratitude to my headmaster and the teachers. Without their commitment, I dare to think what would have happened. But when secondary modern teachers are talked about today, it's in a negative light. That's so unfair. And I wanted to set the record straight, and that's why I dedicated the book to them. It's only a small gift, but I think they'd be pleased. Secondly, I'm fascinated how our understanding of history is distorted by those that write about it. Education policy, more than most, is determined by political ideology, and that all the more likely to be distorted. So I wanted to get on record another account, one that I've done my best to strip of bias and to substantiate by facts and not conjecture. And certainly not conjecture based on political ideology.
All right, okay, I get it. I know how you hate reaching conclusions without having all the facts. I guess you found the history of secondary moderns to be a fact-free zone, that's a term you like using, and wanted to create your own account? Well, let's move on. Tell us how you went about structuring the book.
This is a much easier question to answer. The book is split into five parts. I start with a chapter titled, The Truth is What You Want It to Be. A technical name for the subject I cover is behavioural science. I wanted to understand how and why we reach decisions and how easy it is to distort memories and facts about the past.
Hold on, what's that got to do with secondary moderns?
I have to say, it is a chapter that I did consider dropping. But during writing the book, we've lived through three major events. There was Brexit, Trump's term as president, and, as we all know, the COVID pandemic. I stagger to see how quickly the truth about each of these events has become horribly warped and simplified. So just think what happens to events that occurred half a century ago. I didn't want to fall into the same trap as others and let my own views and background influence the story. The chapter stayed in, and in fact has grown in importance. Just before we recorded this podcast, a columnist in the Times wrote an article with the same name as the chapter. She was horrified that the truth is what you want it to be, and so am I.
I appreciate the problem, and I'm sure we could have an interesting conversation about the difference between the truth and my truth. But that's something we can leave for another day. Let's get back to the book structure.
The next section is what I call the accepted narrative. This is the set of arguments that are invariably used when the schools are discussed. There are about a dozen claims that are made about secondary moderns that appear time and time again. So I wanted to document them and do my best to identify their original source. Then starts the major part of the book, what I call the history timeline. Although my focus was on secondary modern schools, I needed to understand their role in the history of education.
Whoa, sorry, I'm going to have to stop you again. You talk about the history of education. Can you be a bit more specific about what that means?
No problem. That is something I should clarify. The book is about the education system in England and Wales. There are some references to comparisons with other countries, but the focus is on these two countries. Wales had a similar system as England, but there's some important differences that I discuss at length in the book. I was primarily interested in the education of children after the age of 11. Well, it was necessary to discuss the education system for younger children as well as what happens post-school. That is, the development of colleges, polytechnics and the universities. The hardest question was to decide when to start and end the history timeline. The more I studied, the further back in time I had to go. Eventually, I started during World War I and finished in 2004. That's about 90 years of history. The history timeline is divided into three sections, each roughly of a 30-year duration. I think their names explain the time period they cover, but here you are. Between the wars, that's between 1916 and 1944. Birth and death, that's the story from the creation of secondary moderns until the time they were in terminal decline. That's from 1944 until 1974. And the comprehensive era, that's about the schools that replaced them and covers the period 1974 until 2004.
Whoa, that sounds like a lot of work. Is the history section the longest part of the book?
It is, and by a long way. It takes up about 70% of the book, measured in pages. The birth and death chapter, which is really the essence of the story of secondary moderns, takes up about half the history section. Believe me, I was surprised that I'd become a historian. To begin with, I was concerned that my academic training, which had been in science and business, not history, might be a constraint. But the more I studied, the more I realised it's relevant to the undertaking. Much of my career had been spent advising companies how the world was changing and to make sure they changed accordingly. And along the way, I did spend some time in academia at London Business School. I found these business skills and experience were indeed extremely relevant to piecing together the history of secondary moderns. There was a mass of documents, many of them from the National Archives, that needed to be processed. And as you know, lots of our business career has been spent trying to make sense out of the mountains of corporate data. The history of schools was determined by competing pressures from what I think today we would call the stakeholders. the politicians, the civil servants, teachers, parents, academics, and business people. And they're just the main ones. You could also add to that mix the influence of the media, and which in those days was the newspapers. It seemed to me this was little different to the business world, where the interaction of competing stakeholders determines how effectively and how fast companies can change. It was, and it still is, exactly the same in the education world. Sure, my approach to constructing the history is different from that of an academic historian, but I like to think that my business experience added many new insights. To be honest, I like to think it added a big shot of common sense.
After you'd researched and written the history, what was the next part of the book?
Well, this was the section I enjoyed writing the most, because I could now answer the question at the heart of the book. Were the schools much maligned, or a monstrous mistake?
Okay. It sounds like there's a lot to read before getting to the nitty-gritty of what the book is all about. Could I skip reading the history section of the book and go straight to this section?
Well, I guess it's a bit like reading a novel. Yeah, one option is to go straight to the last few pages and find out how the story ends. Depending on whether you like the conclusion, you can then either start at the beginning or decide it's not really worth the effort. The section Much Maligned or Monstrous Mistake is really the equivalent of reading the final pages. So, yes, you could skip the history sections, but I think you would lose much of the book's value. And the evolution of the education system results from a recurring cycle of grand visions, what is right, doing battle with reality, and invariably coming off second best. I mean, only by reading the history section will you really understand what that means.
Keeping with your novel analogy, tell us who were the good guys and the bad guys, and who won?
Kim, this chapter's over 50 pages. There's no way I can condense that down into a simple answer. What I will say is that secondary moderns were certainly much maligned. Numerous mistakes were made, especially during the first decade of their life, but these were not limited to just these schools. They were made throughout the education system and throughout the timeline. Let me finish talking about the book structure, and I will come back to your question and give you some examples. So having finished the section and answered my question, it was a logical place to finish the book. But I decided to continue and just write one more section. It seems such a waste, having spent so much time understanding how the education system had evolved, not to consider what it meant for today's children. This was a fascinating and, to be honest, a rather troubling section to write, but more of that in a moment.
You mean that we can learn anything about education of children in 2021 from what happened in 1916? I'd need a lot of convincing that was true.
Okay, well, look, there's not a direct line connection, a causal link, although you'd be surprised at the similarities. However, the mentality and the frailties of those responsible for education policy has really changed very little. Come on, we're only talking about a century ago. That's nothing in evolutionary time. I mean, look at the behaviours of companies and financial markets. Okay, sure, the technology's changed, but the human reactions and frailties still determine those that succeed and those that fail.
Dick, I know it's difficult to condense the conclusions of the book into a few sentences, but what can you say about its findings?
For much of the timeline, there was a battle waged between competing visions of how society should be organised, and this determined the education system. And it's ironic that the Labour Party that fought to make all children attend comprehensive schools was the political party responsible for establishing secondary moderns. And the Conservative Party, that did its best to defend selective education, oversaw their demise and the growth of comprehensives. Kim, to be brutally honest, much of the way that the education policy was devised and implemented was a horrible mess. As I said before, the accepted narrative about secondary moderns is horribly simplistic, and the intensity and the accuracy of the criticisms have been and continue to be undeserved. That said, the idea that you could know a child's academic abilities aged 11 is plainly daft. The assumptions upon which secondary educations were built following World War II were manifestly wrong. However, at the time, despite all the faults, the selective system really was the only option. I think historians have ignored, well, let's say they fail to recognise the enormity of the disruption caused by the war. Let's put that in the context of today. It would be crazy to launch a whole new system of schooling at the point where children's education has been disrupted by COVID-19. But remember, the upheavals of the pandemic have gone on for just a year. World War II turned children's lives upside down for 5 years. By the time secondary moderns had emerged from the post-war chaos, one of the political parties was set on their destruction and conversion of all the schools to comprehensives. The other, the Conservatives, were intent on protecting the grammar schools. Improving the effectiveness of secondary moderns really wasn't their first priority.
You're not describing a very flattering picture of politicians.
Perhaps not. Let's put it this way. A lot of well-meaning people were doing what they thought was right, even though in hindsight their ideas were impractical and often bound to fail. Those at the sharp end, the teachers who had to pick up the pieces and make the best of what they had, in the main did a terrific job. Central and local government, the civil servants and academia has to carry the blame for much of the waste and the mistakes. When the school's leaving age was raised, on both occasions it was done badly. The system of examinations didn't so much as evolve as stumbled along. Providing enough teachers with the right skills has been a problem throughout the timeline, and it still is. The most serious accusation that can still be made today is that the system of schooling doesn't work for a sizable percentage of children, those with limited academic abilities. I don't have a solution to this problem, but it's clear neither does anybody else.
Well, Dick, I think it's about time we wrapped up this discussion. What message would you like to end with?
Well, firstly, Kim, thanks very much for helping me with this podcast. I'm sure this tale of my schooling is very different to yours in Australia. Secondly, thanks to the listener. I hope you now have a better understanding about the book. I think the best way of finishing this podcast is to read the words I use when concluding the chapter, Much Maligned or Monstrous Mistake. The narrative about secondary moderns blames them for the problems that we now explain away as resulting from inequality, disadvantage, and the multiple failures of society. Secondary moderns weren't a monstrous mistake. They had an impossible job to do and were given abysmal guidance and support on how to do it. No doubt many of their pupils received a rotten education, but many of their pupils did well, far more than the school's critics admit. I was one of the lucky ones, for which I will always be immensely grateful.